Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel deliberately targets journalists to hide its genocide in Gaza as a death toll from the onslaught on the territory nears 19,000. Yemeni armed forces target two Israel-bound vessels in the Red Sea in retaliation for the regime's genocide in Gaza. And pressure builds up on the Israeli Prime Minister as the military announcement on killing Israeli captives in Gaza sparks protests in Tel Aviv. Thank you for joining us. Day 70 of the Israeli war on Gaza, where fresh airstrikes have killed a dozen people in the southern city of Khan Yunis. The attacks in Khan Yunis targeted residential buildings and a UN-run school. The overwhelming number of casualties brought to Nasser Hospital there forced medics to treat the wounded on the floors. Israeli warplanes also hit the southern city of Rafah, killing over two dozen people. Also in Gaza City, at least two civilians were killed after a school was bombed. The total death toll in Gaza is now around 19,000. But Geneva-based NGO, the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, says the toll is 25,000. The Israeli attacks have crippled critical infrastructure in Gaza as well. Palestinian telecommunications firms say services are cut again, hampering rescue efforts. Houses reduced to rubble, hospitals packed with casualties, with nowhere being safe from Israeli bombardment in Gaza. Despite all the pain and suffering, Palestinians vow to continue their resistance in the wake of inaction by international bodies.
We have had enough of this war. I say to Netanyahu, whatever you do, the resistance continues, and our bodies are for the resistance.
The United Nations has been holding Israel responsible since our Nakba in 1948. What happened since then? It's all empty words. We are the ones who pay the price.
They're watching the photos and nobody's saying anything. The bodies are all children, women and old people. They're all civilians. You know the numbers of civilians. Why are you still silent? Until when you will stay silent?
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the Israeli attack that killed an Al Jazeera cameraman in the Gaza Strip on Friday was deliberately targeted at journalists. The movement says the strike on a UN school was an attempt to intimidate news staff documenting the regime's massacres in the Gaza Strip. Earlier, Al Jazeera said an Israeli strike in Khan Yunis wounded two of its news staff. One of them, Samer Abu Dakar, bled to death as Israeli forces prevented paramedics from reaching him. The news network has condemned the attack. It says it holds Israel accountable for systematically targeting and killing its journalists and their families. Over 80 news staff have been killed by the regime forces since October the 7th, when it began its onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Yemen's armed forces say they have targeted two Israel-bound ships in the Red Sea.
The naval units of the Yemeni armed forces, with the help of God Almighty, carried out a military operation against two container ships, MSC Palladium and MSC Alania. They were heading to Israel and were targeted by two appropriate naval missiles.
Sari said the attack came after the two ships refused to respond to warnings by the Yemeni naval forces. The spokesman vowed that all Israel-bound vessels would be targeted, but reassured all other ships passing near Yemeni territory of safe passage. Yemen says the strikes are in response to Israel's deadly onslaught on Gaza. Sana'a says it will continue the attacks until Israel stops its genocide in Gaza and the much-needed food and medicine are allowed into the blockaded strip. Danish shipping company Maersk said it would pause all container shipment through the Red Sea. The company said its shipments would be sent on a detour around Africa until further notice. Israel says its forces have killed three Israelis held by Hamas in Gaza during the regime's ground offensive in the territory. The Israeli military says troopers wrongly identified the captives as threats and shot them dead. The announcement triggered a protest by families and supporters of the captives in Tel Aviv. They demanded an immediate truce in Gaza. The regime's military has killed Hamas-held captives on several occasions. However, more than 100 of them remain in custody in Gaza. That's after a week-long truce in late November that saw Hamas swap more than 100 Israeli captives with 240 Palestinian women and children. The Islamic resistance movement Hamas has turned streets in Gaza into a deadly maze for Israeli forces. The assessment is being made by Israeli experts and an Israeli commander. They say the movement has used weapons, stockpile, knowledge of the terrain, and the vast tunnel network in Gaza to its advantage. Retired Israeli Major General Yaakov Amidror says the Israeli army has not found a good solution for Hamas's tunnel network. Also, foreign policy advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Ofir Falk says Tel Aviv is paying a huge price with the lives of its troopers. The regime has confirmed the deaths of around 110 forces in the offensive since nearly 2 months ago. However, Hamas says the casualties of Israeli forces are much higher and that the regime is hiding the real number. Tensions also remain high along Lebanon's southern border. That's where the resistance movement Hezbollah and Israeli forces have been engaged in clashes since October the 7th. The latest exchange of fire saw a Hezbollah fighter killed in Israeli shelling while resistance forces carried out missile attacks into the occupied territories. Earlier, we were joined by a correspondent, Mariam Saleh, for more details.
Well, today we had intensified Israeli shelling basically on every single town throughout the border. Of course, Kfar Kila, Rabit Letin, Aita, Echiyam, all these towns were targeted. That is on the eastern side. Also on the western side, you had a lot of other towns as well that were targeted. We're talking about Marwahin, Yarin, Aita Shab, they were targeted basically mostly on the outskirts, but you also had targeting in some instances, for example, in Aita Shab and Aita Run, Kfar Kila, for example, and Rabit Letin. Those, we saw how the Israelis with artillery fire, they targeted the heart of those towns. Most of those towns are bordering the southern border, and basically they are mostly have been evacuated. Of course, Hezbollah has also launched several operations. One of the most significant operations was in the against the post of Meitab, where they used the Burkan rocket. And in addition to the use of Burkan rocket, they also launched attacks against several gatherings of soldiers. One infantry was also seen entering the headquarters in its post, and that was also targeted directly by Hezbollah.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israeli forces are crumbling in the Gaza Strip in the face of resistance fighters. Hamas's military wing, the Qassam Brigades, says this is despite the fact that the resistance is pitted against an army equipped with the most advanced weapons and fighter jets. Qassam spokesman Abu Obeida says his fighters have targeted more than 100 Israeli military vehicles only in the last 5 days. The spokesman also says the fatalities of Israeli troopers are multiple times greater than what the regime is acknowledging. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has released footage of a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier as it left the Strait of Hormuz, as well as a warning to the ship to avoid provocation.
By witnessing Sepah Navy Vatio helicopter flying unprofessional and provocative. You copy, huh? Keep your helicopter away from my vessel. U.S. Warship, by witnessing Sepah Navy, for your information, I have some speedboat going to you. Advise you to keep your helicopter away from my vessel, over.
This is Coast Warship 5-8, understand all, over.
In reaction to the incident, the commander of the IRGC's naval forces said the U.S. fleet was being closely monitored during his presence in the Persian Gulf. Rear Admiral Arireza Tangsiri added that the presence of the strike group is only meant for propaganda and has no operational significance. Eisenhower aircraft carrier entered the Persian Gulf in late November and left through the Strait of Hormuz on December the 5th. People in the Afghan capital Kabul have held a gathering in a display of solidarity with Palestinians. The event aimed to raise awareness about the ongoing plight of the Palestinian people and to advocate for peace and justice.
Amid Israel's relentless strikes on the Gaza Strip, many Afghans have gathered to show support for Palestinians. They vehemently denounced the Israeli regime's brutalities and showed their unwavering solidarity with Gaza. The demonstrators proudly brandished the flags of Palestine and displayed banners reading, "Down with Israel and down with USA."
This war is backed by the U.S. That's why it is still ongoing. Nowhere is safe in Gaza today. The Israelis bomb schools, they bomb buildings, they bomb hospitals with support from the U.S.
We have gathered here to call for the cessation of the oppression of the Palestinian nation. To stop the murder of women and children, all Muslims should unite and support Palestine. We are all willing to go to Gaza if made possible by our government.
While expressing their unwavering support for the Palestinian nation and their cause, the demonstrators also voiced their deep-seated frustration at the international community's failure in addressing this crisis and issued a stern condemnation of their inaction.
International organizations are just a tool to legalize horrible crimes committed by arrogant states. They have failed us in the case of Gaza, and this blot is on their hands too. We shouldn't expect such organizations to help, and we Muslims must take action.
Since October 7th, Israel has been committing genocide in Gaza. This demonstration is a ripple in the wave of protests that have taken place worldwide. They all chant the same message, that they stand united with Palestinians. Through this gathering, Afghans are sending a strong message to the global community. They underline that they stand by Palestinians and support them in the fight for their rights and freedom amid Israeli occupation and onslaughts. Abdullah Mirzad, Kabul.
UN officials have sounded the alarm over the worsening humanitarian situation in Gaza. They say no place has been spared from Israeli airstrikes, including locations that should be protected under the law of war. The UN officials say half of the population in Gaza are starving. Here's more.
UN agencies continue to sound the alarm bell over the desperate humanitarian situation in the besieged coastal territory. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has warned that the people of Gaza are running out of time and options. Philippe Lazzaroni warned that Gaza is very far from an adequate humanitarian response.
The people of Gaza are running out of time and options as they face bombardment, deprivation, and disease in an ever shrinking space.
He described the situation in Gaza as hell on earth and said people in the Palestinian territory are facing the darkest chapter of its history since 1948. He described seeing people halting in aid truck and in desperation and swallowing down the food found inside where they stood in the street. Further noted that the people of Gaza are now crammed into less than one-third of their original territory near the Egyptian border, and the dire situation might spark an exodus. The city of Rafah on the Egyptian border, the only crossing where aid is entering Gaza, has seen its population explode from 280,000 to more than a million.
Rafah is the epicenter of the displacement of the Gazan. There is over 1 million people who have fled in this governorate, most of them, as we know, have been moved more than once since the beginning of the war. Rafah has quadrupled
its number of people overnight, and especially when the offensive in the south has started.
UN officials have warned that any such exodus would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and it would make a problematic Palestinian problem more difficult. It is now widely believed that the Israeli regime is deliberately targeting residential areas and the critical infrastructure in Gaza in order to make the territory unlivable for its residents. Israel has already pushed the U.S. and its other Western allies to persuade Egypt to accept Palestinian people in the Sinai Peninsula.
It seems very difficult to us that if there was a population movement outside Gaza, I think that can only mean Egypt. It would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and that would make a solution to the Palestinian problem even more difficult.
The healthcare system is collapsing. Expect public order to completely break down soon. And an even worse situation could unfold, including epidemic diseases and increased pressure for mass displacement into Egypt. I said that we are facing a severe risk of collapse of the humanitarian system.
And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us to Ahlul Bayt and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell."
In the limelight.
Would the Zionist regime have survived without the $130 billion in weapons and military assistance provided by the U.S. since the Zionist regime's creation in 1948? In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites, and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Palestine Chronicle wrote, as the civilian death toll in Gaza continues to rise to unprecedented heights, reaching over 18,000 since October 7th, with more than 46,000 injured, one of the most distressing reports to come out of the war zone is the use of excessively heavy weaponry by the Zionist regime. In a report last month comparing Israeli bombings with U.S. attacks in the West Asia region conflicts, the New York Times pointed out that the aerial bombs used by American forces against Daesh in urban areas in Mosul, Iraq and Raqqa, Syria were 500-pound weapons. But in contrast, the Zionist regime's liberal use of very large weapons in dense urban areas included American-made 2,000-pound bombs that flattened buildings, houses, and an apartment tower in Gaza while killing thousands of Palestinians. Mark Garosco, a former intelligence analyst at the Pentagon, was quoted as saying, "It's beyond anything that I have seen in my career." Now the question is, would Israel have survived without the $130 billion in weapons and military assistance provided by the U.S. since the Zionist regime's creation in 1948? And should Israel be charged with war crimes along with the U.S., the primary arms supplier of Israel? But both scenarios are not likely to happen. Any such attempts in the Security Council, either against the U.S. or Israel, will be vetoed by the Americans, as it happened recently on a resolution for ceasefire in Gaza. The resolution suffered a U.S. veto, even though it had the support of 13 of the 15 members in the Security Council, with one abstention by UK. According to a December 1st report in the Wall Street Journal, the US last week provided the Israeli regime with additional 2,000-pound bombs for the Gaza war. The US has provided the Zionist regime with large bunker buster bombs, among tens of thousands of other weapons and artillery shells, to help dislodge Hamas from Gaza. US officials were quoted as saying, "The surge of arms, including roughly 15,000 bombs and 57,000 artillery shells, began shortly after October 7th attack and has continued in recent days," the official said. The U.S. hasn't previously disclosed the total number of weapons it sent to Israel, nor the transfer of 100 BLU-109 2,000-pound bunker buster bombs. After sending massive bombs, artillery shells, the U.S. also urged the Israeli regime to limit civilian casualties, a warning ignored by the fabricated regime of Israel. The Mark 84, or BLU-117, is a 2,000-pound American general-purpose bomb. It is the largest of the Mark 80 series of weapons. Entering service during the Vietnam War, it became a commonly used U.S. heavy unguided bomb due to the amount of high explosive content packed inside to be dropped. Norman Solomon, Executive Director, Institute for Public Accuracy and National Director, RootsAction.org, told IPS Military Aid from the U.S. government has been essential for Israel to maintain itself as an expansionist country during the last several decades. He said, "That assistance has enabled Israel to systematically crush the human rights of Palestinian people while continuing to violate international law with occupations of Gaza and the West Bank. Israel has used its military might to, in effect, sadistically turn Gaza's residents into abused prisoners. Norman Solomon pointed out that much of the strength of the Zionist armed forces has been due to Washington's extraordinary quantities of support with military aid. Recent events have underscored how the U.S. regime is willing to step up military assistance with massive amounts of weaponry and other war material, while the Zionist regime continues to slaughter civilians in Gaza. Solomon, author of War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine, said, "The wanton and purposeful killings of more than 18,000 civilians during the last 2 months are war crimes that deserve unequivocal condemnation and prosecution. What's more, the U.S. government is more than complicit. It is an accomplice in these crimes against humanity." In recent days, a pair of developments involving the United States government have underscored its direct complicity in the ongoing mass murder by the Zionist regime in Gaza. On December 8, the U.S. regime vetoed a U.N. Security Council resolution for a ceasefire. The next day, the Biden administration disclosed that it is bypassing Congress to sell 13,000 rounds of tank ammunition to Israel. Overall, in Washington, bipartisan zeal is persisting to actively support the slaughter of Palestinian civilians in Gaza. Propaganda efforts to equate calls for a single standard of human decency with anti-Semitism are specious and demagogic, Solomon declared, adding, "Like a growing number of other Jewish Americans, I reject any and all efforts to equate Judaism with the regime of Israel. The government of Israel continues to be engaged in large-scale war crimes with the support of the U.S. government. They should be unequivocally denounced and opposed."
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. Today, on the first of the month of Jamal Dil Thani, we present you a statement from Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, when she told Muslims about perceived signs of weakness of faith among them. "When God perceived the nations divided into different religions, deifying fire and worshipping idols and rejecting Him in spite of their intellect and knowledge, God the Majestic guided and enlightened them from darkness through my father Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and removed the curtains of ignorance from their hearts and illuminated their eyes, relieving them from blindness."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, No to Counterfeit Religious Sayings. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Forging lies against Allah, the Messenger, and the religious authorities is simply forbidden in Islam. Islam is the religion of truthfulness and genuineness. Allah the Most High said, "And who is more unjust than he who forges a lie against Allah?" The biggest injustice is to forge a lie against Allah. This is a crime that Allah has labeled it to be injustice. Forging lies against Allah, Prophet, or Ahlul Bayt, alayhimus salam, hinders the prosperity of a person in this life and the hereafter. Allah says in the Holy Quran, "Surely those who forge lies against Allah shall not prosper. They will have little enjoyment for a while, but theirs will be a painful punishment." Notice that you may have little enjoyment or some gains or some benefits by forging a lie against Allah, but remember that the painful chastisement awaits you. You know, unfortunately, those who fall in love with this world, this dunya, they lie for the sake of their petty gains and benefits, right? They make things up, sometimes just for the sake of enjoyment, right? But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is promising us that yes, you may get that enjoyment for a little period of time, but that is not something that is going to help you in any way, because there will be a painful chastisement waiting for you if you forge any lies against Allah, His Messenger, or religious authorities. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing No to Counterfeit Religious Sayings. And we said that forging lies against Allah, the Messenger of Allah, the Imams of Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, the religious authorities, is forbidden in Islam. We see in history that some hypocrites forged lies against the Prophet for different reasons. Some did it for some personal gains, others did it for enmity against Islam and Prophet. Then there was the corrupt governmental establishment after the Prophet who paid liars to forge lies against the Prophet. The Prophet of Allah during his lifetime said, "Anyone who intentionally forges lies against me prepares for a residence of fire." If one forges a lie against Allah, Prophet, or Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, in the state of fasting, their fast becomes invalidated. This is a serious sin, brothers and sisters. Lying in the name of Allah, Prophet, Imams, or the religious authorities is a no-go for a believer, right? No matter if there are those short-term gains or even some sort of enjoyment or some personal benefits, this is something that is completely forbidden in Islam. And if you look at the history of Islam, just to preserve their authority and power and government, people lied in the name of Prophet, unfortunately, right? You look at the track record of Banu Umayyah and you look at how many statements of Prophet, they were forged, they were fabricated, right, by the hypocrites of that time. So we have to be, as believers, be very careful that when we take a hadith, when we take a narration of the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, we go to the reliable sources and not just believe anything and everything that comes in front of us, because there was a fabrication machinery in place for hundreds and thousands of years, you know, since after Islam. For the last 1400 years, we have seen people fabricate these statements and these sayings. So we have to have our guards up and say no
two counterfeit religious sayings.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Palestine industrial sector.
Part 2.
Three years after the Gaza war, Adel still waiting for the reconstruction of his house to come to an end after a long suppression.
We are working based on the fact that the future will be better, God willing. We prepare what we can. I have some machines that I can secure, some in my brother's house, and some are at my friend's stores. This means I will try to arrange and to resume work in the factory. Of course, I will bring them back to the factory so that we resume the work we used to do. Palestinian human expertise and resources exist. Human resources are the most important element of production factors and is competitive and in transition from quantitative to qualitative side. Some goods were significantly competitive and were exported to Europe, like Spain as well as Italy, where they competed with some Spanish and Italian goods.
Furniture is one of those most internationally competing commodities of Palestine. Gaza is unique among all other Palestinian cities when it comes to furniture. This line of industry depends on creativity and amusement, whereas that's the case with Mohammed Mujtaha's company that gained admiration of one European country that was ready to host the company in one of the key exhibitions held in that state.
I took part in the exhibition in the German city of Cologne, and I wasn't overwhelmed with the furniture that I have seen, because with our capacity, we can make better than that. The Germans were impressed by our excellent goods and industry, that they promised to allow us to actively participate in the exhibition and take goods from Gaza to the City of Cologne exhibition in 2013.
Mohammed Mujtaha's furniture factory, erected from under the rubble too, after being destroyed by Israeli occupation army north of Gaza. The army that insists to ruin every landmark that expressed life and beauty.
Mujtaha Company was founded in 1978 as a family business with two or three workers. Till before the war, we had 40 workers at Mujtaha Furniture Company for house, hotel, and office furniture, along with everything related to furniture and wood. The factory was destroyed during the war, and we came back empty-handed, just like we started.
The
The Israeli occupation destroyed more than 450 industrial establishments in the Gaza Strip. Those facilities were behind the Israeli occupation army during its invasion of the Gaza Strip. And at the moment of withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, they destroyed those factories, as they stayed in most of them during the war.
After the war, Mohammed Mushtaha managed to rebuild his factory and equip it with the needed machinery. Considering the destruction caused by the Israeli occupation army as a collateral incident that won't inhibit the continuation of work.
We have no other option. Where will the workers and I go if I didn't build another factory and work therein? I am compelled to create another factory or two or three because I don't have any other country to work in.
Remaining in Palestine and the reconstruction highlighted the ability of Palestinians to survive, no matter what it takes. Hormuz's family washing machine factory was targeted twice by Israeli occupation army war jets, but the workers were able to fix the factory, while some destruction signs are still evident while they continue their work.
I was the first to introduce stainless steel in all sizes to Gaza. We received it in the form of sheets from the Israeli occupation through rolls weighing 8 to 10 tons each that we cut to make a washing machine from A to Z. The Israeli occupation targeted me twice while I just work in stainless steel. We closed the shop on the first day of the war, the 27th of December, and went back home thinking it's a raid and that things will calm down within an hour or two. We were surprised after Isha prayer the next day that the shop was targeted. We went by car to see what happened. We found everything destroyed. We were determined to run the factory again, so we removed the rubble and cleaned the place to get back to work. We worked for 2 days, then the factory was targeted again.
As said by people in charge, this workshop contributed to providing consumers with washing machines despite the Israeli-imposed siege on Gaza. The workshop could even export its products abroad before the war on Gaza.
We could break the siege by providing stainless steel material and offering our production to the consumer so as not to feel the siege. For this reason, we were among the first targets on the list that the Israeli occupation targeted. The washing machine that we are talking to you about is that you have just seen. It had entered Sudan en route to Ethiopia. This means it's a first class in Gaza. This is something we are proud of, as we are proud of our customers as well.
There is no doubt that the workshop was affected by the destruction, that it is hard now to operate it the same way as before.
I used to have 15 workers in all work fields, of whom some worked on the pistons and washing machines. The number of workers has become 2 today as a result of the closure of the West Bank market and deterioration of the economic situation here. The shelling affected everything, whereas it destroyed new scissors we bought in addition to the generator and the full-time automatic saw that used to operate at night and start to cut and produce while I was home. The Israeli occupation has always been fabricating excuses to obstruct development in agriculture and industry, and is certainly interested in destruction at those levels. The Israeli occupation destroyed iron workshops, claiming that the machines can be used for other purposes. But what is the relationship of a sponge factory, or dairy factory, or any other factory? This is an Israeli occupation systematic program to destroy the structure of the economy to achieve political goals.
It is clear now that by targeting factories and workshops, the Israeli aim was to devastate the Palestinian economy. Maybe targeting the Lulz dairy factory in southern Gaza was yet another proof that the Israeli occupation army is working on a systematic plan to destroy any successful industrial facility that would achieve independence of the Palestinian economy apart from Israeli occupation economy.
At the beginning, we established our factory in 2004-2005 with a production capacity of 1 ton of cheese per day. It was bombed during the 2008 war. The Israeli occupation is not enough with what was destroyed during the last war on Gaza, but still destroying. There are dozens or even hundreds of factories that were destroyed after the war. The Lul factory is one of those factories that was destroyed 4 times instead of one.
The Lul's daily factory was targeted on the first day of Gaza war back in 2008. Then in April 2010, the Lul built another factory in Khan Yunis, some 40 kilometers away from Gaza City, hoping that would stop the occupation from targeting the factory.
I established a factory in Khan Yunis, and we worked with Azda Institution for 4 to 5 months, but the factory was targeted again, and we received a phone call one morning and were told that the factory was destroyed, so workers cannot come to work.
The Lul and all factory workers were puzzled when the factory was targeted again, so they decided to rebuild the factory for the third time, 100 meters away from the ruins of the first factory, which was destroyed in the first time.
This factory was supporting 5 families. I have 10 family members. My brother has 9, and my other brother has 13. We built this factory 100 meters away from this facility. They also targeted the third factory in Gaza in 2010. I am the neighbor of the Lul cheese factory that was shelled several times before I worked there. Of course, the F-16 bombardment was heavy and caused damage to my family's house and to my own apartment more than once.
After the third chilling, Dalul didn't stop working, but he built a fourth factory on the ruins of his first factory, challenging by that the continued war that was waged by Israeli occupation army on him and his factory.
This factory worked for about a year or more. On the 6th of June 2012, we were surprised that the Israeli occupation targeted it, while there was absolutely no escalation at all in that period. The total loss for my family is now 4 factories that were totally destroyed by the occupation. When a crew from the International Committee of the Red Cross came here after the bombardment, I talked to one of them, and he told me that it was a move to destroy the Palestinian economy. We don't know the reason behind the bombardment till now, and they also failed to reveal the reason to us.
The fourth factory was destroyed. Many people might be thinking there is no point in building a fifth factory, or else it will end up destroyed, like the 4 other factories.
I was establishing the factory I am using now before the other factory was targeted. I established it under my house and my brother's house, so the factory was right beneath us. Today, I have a factory and machinery to produce enough cheese, milk, and labneh for the whole Gaza Strip. The occupation is still dealing with us with power, not with morals. We are still building while the occupation destroys. We have no other place than this homeland. We have the industries we learned from our parents and grandparents, so we are steadfast in this homeland.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Top Biden administration officials are scrambling to keep border talks alive as a deal with Senate Republicans over Ukraine funding has grown increasingly elusive. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story. Biden administration on Tuesday, 12th of December, indicated to congressional lawmakers that it would be willing to support a new border authority to expel migrants without asylum screenings, as well as a dramatic expansion of immigration detention and deportations to convince Republicans to back aid to Ukraine. Four people familiar with the matter told CBS News. The White House informed Senate Democrats that it could back those sweeping and hardline immigration policy changes as part of the negotiations over President Biden's emergency funding request, a roughly $100 billion package that includes military aid to Israel, Taiwan, and Ukraine, as well as money to bolster border enforcement and hire additional immigration officials. For weeks, a small group of senators have been attempting to reach an immigration enforcement deal. Republicans have conditioned any further assistance to Ukraine to policy changes designed to reduce the unprecedented levels of illegal crossings along U.S.'s southern border with Mexico. During a press conference at the White House on Tuesday, 12th of December, President Biden said his team is working with Senate Democrats and Republicans to try to find a bipartisan compromise, both in terms of changes in policy and to provide the resources we need to secure the border. He said he has offered compromise already, adding that holding Ukraine funding hostage in an attempt to force through an extreme Republican partisan agenda on the border is not how it works. We need real solutions, he said. In recent days, the Biden administration has intensified its engagement with lawmakers. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas started engaging with negotiators in the Senate this week, Three people with knowledge of his engagement have confirmed to CBS News. Alejandro Mayorkas was on Capitol Hill on Tuesday afternoon as lawmakers continued talks aimed at reaching a deal before Congress adjourns for the holidays. A senior Department of Homeland Security official said Mayorkas and other Department of Homeland Security officials are providing technical assistance to lawmakers and their staff, not negotiating policy proposals. Specifically, the White House indicated that it would support a new, far-reaching legal authority to allow U.S. border officials to summarily expel migrants without processing their asylum claims. The measure would effectively revive the Trump-era Title 42 pandemic order and allow officials to pause U.S. asylum law without a public health justification. The administration would also back a nationwide expansion of a process known as expedited removal that allows immigration officials to deport migrants without court hearings if they don't ask for asylum or if they fail their initial asylum interviews. The program is currently limited to the border region. Moreover, the Biden White House would be willing to mandate the detention of certain migrants who are allowed into the country pending the adjudication of their claims. It's unclear how this provision would work, since the U.S. government has never had the detention space to detain all migrants who cross into the country illegally. Biden administration officials and some Senate Democrats have also previously indicated a willingness to raise the initial screening standard for so-called credible fear interviews that migrants have to pass to avoid being deported under expedited removal. In a statement, White House spokesperson Angelo Fernandez said the administration did not have determined policy positions in the congressional negotiations. The White House has not signed off on any particular policy proposal or final agreements, and reporting that ascribes determined policy positions to the White House is inaccurate. The president has said he is open to compromise, and we look forward to continued conversations with Senate negotiators as we work towards a bipartisan package. The Biden administration's willingness to entertain broad restrictive changes to U.S. asylum and immigration laws, including measures resembling Trump-era policies, may increase the likelihood of Republicans supporting its foreign aid package. But even if a bipartisan deal is forged in the Senate, it is unclear if the resulting legislation would win approval in the House of Representatives. The website politico.com has also covered the same story and tells us more. Top Biden administration officials are scrambling to keep border talks alive as a deal with Senate Republicans over Ukraine funding has grown increasingly elusive. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, White House Deputy Chief of Staff Natalie Quillian, and Schwanza Goff, Director of the White House Office of Legislative Affairs, on Tuesday afternoon, 12th of December, met on Capitol Hill with Senate negotiators. Senators Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, Kyrsten Sinema, Independent of Arizona, James Lankford,